First today, across the Atlantic. Go ahead, London.
This is London. John McVane speaking. Military quarters in London have no information today on the Japanese plane who have captured Mandalay. Flying weather here was bad last night. The Luftwaffe stayed at home and the British didn't raid Germany. Some British coastal command planes bombed enemy shipping off the Norwegian coast and hit a destroyer. RAF fighter bombers attacked German aerodromes in occupied France. A German miner from the Ruhr told the National Conference of Miners in London yesterday that Hitler's speech was in part directed against a secret movement among the miners of Germany. He called on German workers to sabotage Hitler's war machine and the German war industry. The German delegate said, "The illegal fighting committee of the miners in Germany has combined with the fighting committee of the iron and steel workers. They've appealed to the people to demand shorter hours of work, more pay, Sundays off, and opposition to the war. But there are a few people here who think that secret opposition to Hitler will have any real importance inside Germany until after the German army is smashed. Most observers feel that as long as Hitler keeps his army, and while he can continue to hold out the hope of victory, the great bulk of the German people will keep on backing him. It's only when they know that the army is smashed that the Germans will start revolt against Hitler in the hope that some other type of government will lessen the force of the blow against Germany itself. The British feel instinctively that it will take more than a near blitz to win the war in the West against Germany. That's why they're pressing for a second front. How soon that second front will come seems to depend chiefly on one thing, ships. Whether the Allies can build ships quickly in quantities that weren't dreamed of before war began. One British military expert, General Sir Herbert Gough, today takes up in the London Evening Standard the military features of a possible second front. General Gough says, "To lose a battle, to fail to gain a victory, because you haven't used all your available troops, is a sure sign of bad generalship." He says the problem facing the British High Command is, can we face the risk of a Russian defeat, or even a drawn battle, while we have troops who, if employed, might ensure a victorious decision? And the British expert says there can be but one answer. The British can't. The general declares that the British mustn't take any half measures, as in Norway and Greece. And he adds, "It's not giving away any secrets to suggest that with British, Canadian, and American troops, we might put a sufficient force in the continent to defy anything which Marshal Rundstedt could collect." General Gough points to the narrowest part of the channel as the place where least shipping would be needed to move and supply an army. He suggests that to hold a strip of occupied country would form a rallying point for all the revolts in Europe, would protect Britain from invasion, and would form a base from which a further advance could be made when the situation on the Russian front made conditions favorable. Meanwhile, the British are seeing in their papers plain evidence of the destruction RAF planes are causing in Germany. Pictures of the bombed Heinkel aircraft factory in Rostock are being published. You can see the holes in the roof, battered planes, and other signs of heavy damage. Air Ministry circles express the belief that salvage, not aircraft, will be the factory's main output for some time to come. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
Now, here in New York, we have news from Moscow. Russian guerrilla forces were reported today to have killed 5,000 German troops in sanguinary clashes in the vicinity of Orel, 200 miles southwest of Moscow. The guerrilla action was said to have set free 345 villages from German control. And fierce fighting was continuing on the Kalinin front to the northwest, the Red Army High Command said, with 900 Germans being struck down in 2 days of battle. Guerrilla activity in the vicinity of Leningrad was said to be taking an increasing toll of Germans. Occupying several villages to the rear of the main German lines, the guerrillas were said to have slain about 1,000 Nazis in 3 days of fighting. The Moscow radio quoted a report from the Stockholm newspaper, Aften Tidningen, stating that 1,800 Russian prisoners of war had escaped with the help of German soldiers from the Oslo Kristiansund area in Norway. Only 20 of those who broke out of the prison camps were caught by the Nazis, it was added. A dispatch here from Russia also. The Moscow radio says the German soldiers have helped 800 Russian war prisoners to escape from internment in Norway. And 64 additional Red Army men got away from another internment place. The Moscow broadcast quotes a Swedish newspaper as the source of the escape news. News of the Pacific fighting now from our newsroom in San Francisco.
And now we call in our correspondent with United Nations headquarters in Australia. Go ahead, Australia.
This is Martin Agronsky calling from Allied headquarters in Australia. Yesterday it was raid and counter-raid again off northern Australia. And at 6 o'clock tonight, it was revealed that yesterday morning, for the first time since the war began, two unidentified military planes flew over Townsville, some 1,200 miles south of Australia's northeastern tip. Neither anti-aircraft fire nor attempts to intercept the planes were successful. Townsville is the furthest south the Jap planes have yet penetrated. It is where Australia's heavy population area begins. And though the official report is not publishable yet, the bitter fight for aerial supremacy in the north continued today. Yesterday, we hit the Jap airdrome at Gazmata in New Britain. The Japs raided an aerodrome at Port Moresby in New Guinea. Neither we nor the Japs are sitting at home waiting for visitors. The offensive spirit is more than a phrase of the men of MacArthur's command, and the Japs in this area, as in every other area in which they have operated, have been on the offensive from the word go. So what it adds up to, and I use the words of one of our commanders, is that both we and the enemy are stretching out offensive fingers, probing for a weak spot in the opposing defenses. On our maps, the sweep of the arc indicating operations executed against the Jap invasion bases off northern Australia has extended steadily each day for the past 2 weeks. If it were possible to get a look at the Jap operational arc, it would show the same kind of steady expansion. So far, we've had the edge in this far-flung aerial war, but it cannot be emphasized too often that the ease and rapidity with which the Japs consistently make good their aerial losses means we have yet to damage their sources of supply, or even yet to destroy their machines in a ratio greater than their available replacements. Naturally, it would be a value to the enemy to estimate the size of the Jap forces. This much I can say. They are reported large enough to carry out a full-scale attack whenever they think the moment appropriate. I have studied, watched the Japs operate in Malaya and Java. I've studied their campaign in Burma. And all their strategy, the one basic factor from which they never deviate, is this. The Jap attack is always to outflank and to cut off. Never, till the enemy is badly broken, do they launch a frontal assault. The Japs, it's evident from their plan of campaign in this area so far, are sticking faithfully to this technique. Fort Moresby, our major base in New Guinea, may have been the hardest hit so far of our outlying bases. But the Jap attacks within the past couple of days on our Solomon Islands base of Tulagi is regarded here as perhaps a more important indication of Japanese intentions than are their attacks on Port Moresby in New Guinea or on Darwin in Australia itself. The Solomon Islands, New Britain, New Ireland, and finally New Caledonia, if completely occupied by the Japs, would fit ideally into their outflanking technique. If they have more force immediately available in this area than we do, they might naturally figure their chances for a successful offensive in the Pacific Islands are better than our chances of a successful defense there. We may fool them by turning up with more strength than they expect. On the other hand, they may bring off successfully their attack. These are the probables. What seems a certainty is that these outlying Pacific Islands of northern and eastern Australia are the places to watch. This is Martin Agronsky returning you now to San Francisco.
And now for further reports, we take you to Earl Godwin in the newsroom in Washington.
And good morning, folks. This week in Washington ends with a rising interest in just the sort of things that folks talk about at home and think about. And here's one of them. Congress is probably going to have a vote on this red-hot question of easing men into Army and Navy commissions by pull or social or political preference, while a draft board drafts his neighbor or his neighbor's son or the farmhand. That's the kick which a former World War soldier in Congress, Representative Faddis of Pennsylvania, has translated into an amendment in the Army pay bill, which comes up on the floor of the House early next week. Faddis, who has experience, says he has seen many men slaughtered because of incompetent officers, and he wants to stop nondescript commissioning by a law requiring all commissions should be the result of proper schools or training. Faddis claims the Navy is as derelict in this as the Army. Then another congressman, Senator Johnson of Colorado, member of the Senate Military Affairs Committee, figures that the matter of dependency would be settled considerably if the government would quit taking men with dependents for the Army and put these men with families into war industry jobs. We are approaching the time, too, when we will be calling men with minor physical ailments, putting them into tip-top shape, and then into uniform. The Army also wants young men, 18 to 20, under the draft age, to enlist now. And by the way, the women will not register for war industry yet, but you, up there in Connecticut, I want you to listen. Don't let that stop the voluntary registration which the Nutmeg State has on hand for Monday next. That's a state matter, and it's entirely voluntary. Many, many people would not know how to spell the word Tommy without using the letter T, and I think just about as many here are puzzled over how to maintain a nationwide level of prices without holding down wages. There has been what some folks around here call dodging of the wage-fixing matter. The President and the War Labor Board at present favor a stabilizing process, but not a cold, hard freeze in one spot as are prices. But there are those who think the President's anti-inflation program will not succeed without wage fixing and other hard-boiled economic helps. And so, Senator Clark of Missouri and Representative Albert Gore of Tennessee are both working up bills and legislation to present to the Congress to fix wages as well as prices. And Gore includes compulsory saving, that is, having a part of your wages handed to you in war bonds. Already, behind the administration scenes, there is considerable dissatisfaction with the President's plan on price control. So far, the dissatisfaction is simply conversation. Many of the more hard-boiled members of the government here, the faction that doesn't like the present situation, are firmly convinced that the President's plan, economic price control plan, and anti-inflation plan will break down without a more rigorous wage control. But at the same time, it is easy to predict that there will certainly be no wage-fixing law through Congress at this season anyhow. The world needs American wheat, and from that standpoint, we would ordinarily grow more and ship more, but we have more wheat than there are ships, and the world starves and looks on as the wheat growers in more than 40 states are asked whether they want to continue the quota system. And the Navy announces that 5,486 Americans are dead or missing in naval action so far in the war. That four-month total, half again as large as the casualty list for the entire World War, when some 3,500 officers and men were killed in action or lost. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is all from Washington at this time.
Thank you, Mr. Godwin. Well, ladies and gentlemen, the reporters you've heard this morning on our regular early morning news roundups have been John McVain speaking from London, Robert Magadoff, whom we had scheduled but didn't contact, in Kuibyshev, Martin Ogronsky from Australia, and Earl Godwin from our own capital. Now, you know, this is a regular morning news feature every day of the week, Monday through Saturday, and we suggest that for the latest news, you keep tuned to this station.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.